You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And on a bigger level, I think we need to look at the kind of global role that countries like the United States and Canada play and how our foreign policies contribute to displacing people and pushing them into the migrant stream.
That's the voice of Dr. Aviva Chomsky. On this week's edition of Latin Waves, we speak to Dr. Chomsky about her book, They Take Our Jobs, and 20 Other Myths About Immigration. Stay tuned.
Dr. Aviva Chomsky has written extensively on the kinds of rights that are denied to many immigrants. In her wonderful book, she dismantles 21 of the most widespread myths and beliefs about immigrants and immigration. Her book is titled, They Take Our Jobs. We're very privileged to have Dr. Aviva Chomsky on our show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
Now, you've written extensively, not just on the causes of immigration, what causes people to move from a place where they belong, where they are respected and where they have roots, to places where they're invisible. Let's begin there. Let's talk a little bit about the social and economic conditions that drive people from their homelands and most things they care about.
Well, Juan Gonzalez wrote a great book a couple of years ago called Harvest of Empire. And in his title, he expresses his argument that immigration is the harvest of empire. That is, the conditions that if you look at the global flows of migration in the world today, there's a really clear flow from former colonies into former colonial powers. So you have immigrants coming into the United States from places like Mexico, from Southeast Asia, other parts of the Caribbean, Central America, South America. You see immigrants going into France from Algeria. You see immigrants going into England from India and Pakistan. That the colonial relationship in lots of different ways sets the stage for later migrations. One of the ways it sets the stage is impoverishing the colony and enriching the colonial power. So you see the flow of resources out of the colony into the colonial power, and you see cultural ties set up. And, of course, you see people from the colonial power going into the colony, that is, the British in India or the Americans, U.S. Americans going into Mexico, never stopped to ask for visas. They just invaded and took over. So those ties are set up by, in a sense, the free movement of people. And then the colonial powers clamp down and say, oh, but wait a minute, we can't have that movement going the other way. We're allowed to go everywhere, but they have to stay in these prisons that we created for them.
Immigrants are being used to scapegoat some of the issues the government is having with relation to a downturn economy. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between the loss and the criminalization that enables not only the oppression, but the dehumanizing treatment that many of these workers receive?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a new book right now, and I was writing earlier this morning, and I was thinking about the question, what part of illegal don't you understand? And thinking, actually, people don't understand anything about the term illegal, and I'd rather turn back and ask those people, well, what part of illegal do you understand? Like, you really have no idea what you're talking about. You were saying something about naturalizing oppression and naturalizing this category of illegal as if it was something clear-cut and natural, that we should divide people up into sort of caste-like categories and label some of them legal and some of them illegal is actually quite a bizarre thing for human beings to do if you really step back and think about it. Clearly, maintaining a portion of the United States population without full civil rights has been true in the United States ever since the United States has come into being. And using that portion of the population that's maintained without full civil rights to do the dirtiest work of society has also been a constant in U.S. history. Today, we use this unnatural concept of illegal to justify keeping a portion of the population in the kind of conditions that's going to force them to do underpaid labor that basically sustains the standard of living of the rest of us. There's certainly nothing just or natural about it. And then on top of that, they get scapegoated. That is, the idea that immigrants are harming the economy then just serves to justify further exploitation of immigrants.
I want to talk a little bit about the myths that allow us to almost make this oppression of people invisible. This, you know, injustice is everywhere, is all around us. And yet it's almost as if you can't see it because it's so inbred and ingrained in our societal norms. So let's talk a little bit about some of the myths. In your book, you titled They Take Our Jobs. Talk about the relationship between this idea that immigrants are actually a burden on the local economy. They're a burden on our countries, and that they take rather than contribute.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's one of the most upside-down myths at all when you actually look at the impact of immigrants on the economy, because immigrants are, in fact, working at the very worst jobs in the economy, using very little in the way of social services and paying far more than their share of taxes. So they're contributing their underpaid labor and they're also contributing their taxes, and they're really getting practically nothing back from the society for what they pay into it, because they're not eligible for most social services that citizens are eligible for. The phrase immigrants take American jobs is thrown around so much. It's one of those things, it's almost like if you hear it enough times, it's going to become true. First of all, we live in a global economy, and we've lived in a global economy for many, many years. And if you want to look at some of the different factors that have affected unemployment rates in this country, one of the biggest ones has been the shift of manufacturing abroad. That is, jobs lost in the manufacturing sector because companies have decided that they could make greater profits by evading things like U.S. minimum wage law and environmental protections and health and safety protections in the United States, and shifting their production somewhere else. That's one big cause of unemployment. Another big cause of unemployment in the United States is government cutbacks, where people in almost every level of government services, from teachers to social workers, federal, state, and local employees, are losing their jobs because of government cutbacks. Neither of those has anything to do with immigration. And in fact, immigrants tend to fill the job sectors that nobody who has a choice would choose to do. And I'll just give you one example. I'm not sure if this is also the case in California, but certainly in Massachusetts, if you get a daily newspaper delivered, it's very likely delivered by an undocumented immigrant. Newspaper delivery is one of the worst jobs you can practically imagine. You have to get up at 2:30 in the morning and work from 2:30 in the morning till 7:30 in the morning. It's pretty much all done out of your car. You're driving, and it's basically the most difficult manual labor, jumping in and out of your car to put people's newspapers where they want them for 3 or 4 hours every morning. And, of course, it's an expensive job to have because you have to maintain a car and maintain insurance and all of those things. And it's a very, very low-paid job. And on top of that, I don't know if you follow the weather reports on the East Coast, but we've had a series of blizzards this winter that have basically shut down the entire state. And the governor declares a state of emergency and says that everybody should stay in their houses. People should not go out on the street because of the snowplows. Most people's workplaces either close or tell them to come in late or to use their judgment about whether it's safe to be on the road, whether to go into work or not. But the newspaper delivery companies tell their employees that they had better find a way to be there and get all those papers delivered, or they're going to lose their roots. This is the kind of job that we're talking about when we say that jobs that Americans don't want are the sectors that immigrants are forced into and can't really protest about their working conditions because of their undocumented status.
I want to also bring another concept that I think has become very popular, and that is the idea of cuts. The common use of the immigrant as the scapegoat for social cuts. They become a burden because they don't pay taxes. They're illegally, so they're not contributing their share. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how this willfulness to create a dual society, both in Canada and the U.S., where you have a large number of people as undocumented and the rest of the population, being able to shift the guilt of government's lack of investment or poor judgment in deregulating banking, reducing taxes for the rich, has created a much larger burden on the middle class, the working class of this country, where that blame is now placed on the most insecure and most vulnerable citizens. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the laws that have gone to not only criminalize the victims of these policies, but also the way in which the society as a whole almost is unable to see them as equals.
Well, in terms of the laws, I think most people really became aware of the legal situation when Arizona passed SB 1070. And a lot of people were outraged at SB 1070, but didn't really realize how much of SB 1070 has already been put into effect through federal law, especially through the 287G program, which trains local police to essentially become enforcers of immigration law. 287G is a voluntary program, but it's a federal program that invites local law enforcement agencies at either the city, county, or state level to collaborate with ICE by going through a training and basically empowering themselves as enforcers of immigration law, which is pretty much what SB 1070 tried to do, and the secure communities, which forces local law enforcement agencies to also become enforcers, essentially become enforcers of immigration law by forcing them to share all information with ICE. That is, it puts ICE everywhere, so that if you're stopped for a traffic violation, your data is going over to ICE. Now, local law enforcement agencies in general have been very opposed to these kinds of laws and programs. They've often been forced into them by mayors and city councils and sheriffs. But the police enforcers on the ground hate these programs because their job is policing the communities that they work in, and they need to maintain good relations with the people in the communities. Their job is protecting the population. And if people are afraid of being turned into immigration, they're going to evade the police, and it ruins the ability of the police to act locally. And yet, 287G has been implemented nationwide, and Secure Communities is in the process of being implemented nationwide. So the legislative situation is actually very grim.
You know, many of these laws also help or create an ability for the average citizen to legitimize the injustice that are committed against immigrants and the oppression and repression that they are victims of.
Underlying a lot of the sort of right-wing populist appeal of these laws is something you mentioned earlier, the idea that, well, immigrants aren't contributing, so we have to save ourselves by punishing immigrants and getting rid of immigrants. And that leads to another one of the myths that I talk about in the book, which is that immigrants don't pay taxes. In fact, the vast majority of immigrants pay taxes. In fact, all immigrants pay taxes of one sort or another, because it's impossible to engage in any economic transaction in this country without paying taxes. You know, paying rent, buying a house, buying gas, buying a car, buying food, any economic transaction is going to be taxed in one way or another. But most immigrants also pay payroll taxes. That is, either by using a TIN, a taxpayer identification number, or by using a false Social Security number, people who are undocumented, most of them, in fact, do pay taxes. They pay into the system, and we see this especially in the case of Social Security, where if you use a false Social Security number, the taxes are deducted from your paycheck. Your Social Security and other taxes are deducted. But you have no actual account with Social Security because your name doesn't match the number. So Social Security Administration takes the money, and it's kept in what they call a suspension file, which currently takes in about $7 billion a year from people who are paying into Social Security but are never going to be able to collect because their name doesn't match the Social Security number that they were using. So that $7 billion a year is basically subsidizing the Social Security system for all of the rest of us who have valid Social Security numbers. So that's just one of the ways in which the contribution that immigrants are making is so disproportionate, and yet the government uses them as an excuse to to try to explain the economic suffering that's going on in the middle classes.
In your book, you're very good at pointing out one of the most important myths, and that is in Canada, we call ourselves a multicultural society. In the U.S., the myth is that the United States is a melting pot that has always welcomed immigrants from all over the world. And I wonder if you could talk about the racial discrimination that is part and is so ingrained in immigration policies, but that most of us fail to see because we've been told that we live in a colorblind society, that you know we welcome everybody. They just have to come to the right routes. Is there a queue for everybody? In my opinion, there seems some people don't have a queue.
You know, it's always seemed kind of ironic to me in the United States how many, many white people say, well, my ancestors came here legally, and as if this is something that they're very proud of. But if you look at the history of U.S. immigration law, the reason their ancestors came here legally is there were no restrictions on white immigration. There were only restrictions on immigration of people of color. And in fact, during the first 100 years of this country's history, the restrictions were not restrictions on immigration, they were restrictions on citizenship of people of color. So as long as there were restrictions on citizenship, where people of color could not be citizens of the United States, there was not only free immigration of people of color, there was forced immigration of people of color through the slave trade. And that was all legal. But it's not necessarily something to be proud of, that the law has always favored people of your race, and that your ancestors were able to take advantage of unfair laws that favored people of their race. It's not necessarily something to be ashamed of either. That is, we can't control what the laws were 100 years ago, but we shouldn't go around bragging about the fact that we were able to benefit from unfair advantages, or that our ancestors were. Is there a line? People always say, well, why don't they get in line and wait? Well, the reason they don't get in line and wait is that there is no line. And I think that that's something that people really don't understand. That is, if you come from a European country, there's a line. If you come from Mexico, there's a line for some people, but for most people, there is no line. And that's something that I think people really need to grapple with, that there is no line. People are being forced by U.S. economic policies in Mexico out of their subsistence lives and into the immigrant stream, and then they're told there is no line. The only way you can survive and feed your family is by immigrating, but there's no line to get in to do it.
In your book, you point out that there is a problem with immigration, but it's not the immigrants that are the problem. So what can a society who is intent on creating a more inclusive and a more humane society where we recognize the inherent value of every human life do to make our country's immigration policies reflective of that?
Well, I think there's two things we can do. And one has to do with domestic policies and immigration policies. And I think, you know, both in the United States and Canada, we hold on to this myth that we believe that people should be treated equally and that there shouldn't be discrimination against any group of people. We should make that a reality. That is, we really should treat people equally, regardless of immigration status, as well as regardless of any other status. And we really shouldn't discriminate against anybody for any reason, including the immigration status. I think we need to change our immigration policies and laws so that they don't discriminate against people who are trying to come into our countries. And on a bigger level, I think we need to look at the kind of global role that countries like the United States and Canada play and how our foreign policies contribute to displacing people and pushing them into the migrant stream. And when I say, is immigration a problem? For most people who are forced to migrate, immigration is a huge problem. They're forced to, as you said at the very beginning, leave their friends and families and communities and to go to a place where they're not welcome, where they may not know anybody, where they're discriminated against. This is a huge problem. Most people who migrate would rather stay home if they could, and it's the global economic system, basically under the control of countries like the United States and Canada, that creates the economic circumstances that force people to migrate.
Thank you so much for being with us. You've written many books. You have an upcoming book as well. Tell us about it.
Yeah, the Cuba book is called A History of the Cuban Revolution, and it came about because I've been teaching the Cuban Revolution for many years and taking students to Cuba while it was still allowed. And one little piece of good news is that it's now allowed again, educational travel to Cuba. Obama did manage to do one good thing in terms of foreign policy and has reopened educational travel to Cuba. But I really haven't found the right book to use in my Cuba classes. I like to use books that are really accessible and that really get into these kinds of myths. And in a way, the immigration book and the concept of the myths was really with me when I was writing the Cuba book, because certainly American students hold a lot of myths about Cuba. So although the book isn't explicitly organized around myths, it's definitely that concept is in there. Mm-hmm. So it's a very brief college-level text on the history of the Cuban Revolution that tries to give an introduction that breaks those myths that so many people in this country have about Cuba.
Thank you so much. Dr. Abiba Chomsky is a professor of history and coordinator of Latin American Studies at Salem State College. She is the author of several books. And how can people access your books?
Well, the immigration book is published by Beacon Press, so you can get it straight off the Beacon Press website, or you can get it from any online bookseller or have your local bookstore order it. The Cuba book is also published by Wiley Blackwell, and it's available direct from them or from any bookseller.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thanks so much for the chance to talk to you.
Take care.
Before I put on the final song, I want to reiterate that immigrants and other workers become scapegoats for those in power, whose economic policies have failed the majority of people. I discovered a new term this week which explains this behavior. It's called horizontal violence, which is defined as harmful behavior via attitudes, actions, and words and other behaviors that is directed towards us by another colleague. In short, the recession was not caused by the working class or undocumented workers, but the deindustrialization of the country, offshoring of jobs and the destruction of a livable wage, and the speculative trading by bankers and other insiders. Let's focus on the real culprits of this recession. Let's adopt a new term called vertical violence and point our anger where it belongs. Thanks for listening this week. Bye for now.
We're not being taught to deal with the world as it is. We're being taught to deal with this fairyland, which we're not even living in anymore. It's sad, because I'm telling you, and it should not be me telling you.
But whatever he thinks is right, he's from Texas, he's got to be right.
Bueno, y vamos con el tema de esta noche.
The language they speak in Latin America is Latin, true or false.
Abro mi boca, ojos cerrados y el mundo color boca. Tantas veces me he sentido solo, mano en boca. Mi indigestión, nueva gestión de mi tiempo. Esto es mi testamento, yo me voy, llamo, lo siento. Arreglando mi crisis, apocalipsis interior. Mi chiquita, fin del mundo, paso sin temor. Ya se murió mi mala suerte, mi nube negra. Pon una nube de leche en mi café, nena. Azúcar también, palabras cruzan también. Por eso duermo bien si por lo menos toco a alguien. Imbécil, mi tesis es la historia de un cambio de energía que me trae gloria. Sigue mi filosofía hasta que me muera. Mi lucha es mi arte como un baile de capoeira. Fuera del tema de la vida no queda nada. Pana mata el miedo y quédate firme como zapata. Al ritmo del palo vi de la lata. El sol aparece, alquimia personal, no es nada fatal. Por eso te lo digo, arriba este instrumental. No vale más el
injustice. The blood in the streets, our rats, our homes, the property to lease. I know we gon' get it again. I know we gon' rise to the end. Injustice, it's the blood in the streets, our rats, our homes, the property to lease. I know we gon' get it again.
Check my voice that resonates, my rib cage is filled with magnetic fuel, 12 jewels, dudes to serve fools, reach like a telephone. Weeks I've been alone and find I laugh in my zone so I can write this few songs. The school of life is my home, I'm roaming like a home, a bum, executing stunts, supporting beer bottle. It seems like the dust can never settle in the streets. Rich is always in need, just like a mouth to feed. A melted pot will be so get along, acting fake like silicone. All the layers defective, it's time to say a prayer. Don't count on your mayor, it's all human behavior. The words
the planet that we can make a difference. My appeal, schizophrenic topic, switching like split personality. My alter ego, just satisfy my need for change. We form from a worm, form the butterfly. No need no alibi to justify this crime.
Injustice keeps on flooding the streets and wrecks our homes when prophecy leaks.
Sont des questions à poser. Combien dirigeants ton cerveau paralysé, brisé, couillon esquelette pulvérisé. Quelqu'un y'a premier utilité, y'a tête qui poise. Pitié, y'a de tout bien haut pour qu'arriver. Y'a mon réussi, son projet réalisé. Y'a bête de moins, son tête de plus en vérité, son bénéfice. Souffle les sorties sous l'ombre et son fou sacrifice. Quel vieil activiste, car j'ai tout chimiste. Y'a putain, j'ai passé n'importe quel virus. Affirmatif, formatif, positif, veillatif. Et tes proches y'a compagnons qui construit nos besoins, chef. Pour créatif, même j'avais le grève. Chant, ma vie, paye ou bien, mais fais tout ce qu'on aime pour pas quitter le traîné. Ton courage, fais mon pas tout, mais en fait.
Injustice keeps on flooding the streets. I rats our homes with prophecy leasing. I know we gon' get it again. I know we gon' fight till the end. Injustice keeps on flooding the streets. I rats our homes with prophecy leasing. I know we gon' get it again.
Fue el que empezó a atacar verbalmente a todos los periodistas, a los camarógrafos, y fue el que dio inicio a la trifulca.
That was the incredible lyrics and music of Pneumatic Massive and their song title, Say the Least. For information on their music, you can go to pneumaticmassive.org. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.